From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump today called the Reverend Billy Graham a very special man who will be missed by Christians and people of all faiths. Graham died today at the age of 99. He was a spiritual advisor to presidents for decades and preached Christianity around the world.
Meanwhile, today, student survivors of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, are rallying in Tallahassee for lawmakers to enact stricter gun control. Students shouting, shame on you. This afternoon, President Trump holds a listening session with survivors of school shootings at the White House. Here now, political analysts join us now. Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Angela Rye, Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
How are you?
Doing well, and thanks to both of you for being here. Yesterday, President Trump directed the Justice Department to draw up federal regulations to ban gun devices known as bump stocks. Here he is.
We must move past cliches and tired debates and focus on evidence-based solutions and security measures that actually work and that make it easier for men and women of law enforcement to protect our children and to protect our safety.
Paris, do you see Trump getting something done on gun control?
I think what we've seen the president do in the wake of the Parkland tragedy is pretty historic, because for so many instances, we've all said that Republicans won't do anything, the presidents have not done anything, and that includes prior administrations. And so when you see what President Trump has been doing, including the listening session that he's having today, this afternoon, when you look at the openness and the going on the record and saying he's open to working with Senator Cornyn and his bill, and then when you see what he directed the department to do yesterday when it comes to these bump stocks, it shows that there's a willingness for the president to find a solution that makes sense and not just have the tired status quo cliche ban all guns or we need gun control in general. It's looking at the specific things that can actually be done to save lives while respecting the Second Amendment and people's right to protect themselves and their families. And I think the last point is this. The president focusing on mental health is important, and it's because we oftentimes forget about the human element of all of these things that happen. Yes, there's guns involved. Yes, there are AR-15s, but we have to look at why that is driving these people to do these crimes.
Angela, what do you think? And do you think that something will be done this time on gun control?
I have to be honest with you, Jeremy. I just hope so, right? I think that we have to get to a point where our decency, where the character, where the moral fiber of this country means more than partisanship. And we know that while President Obama was in office, this is something that couldn't move, both because people didn't want Barack Obama to have a win, even if it meant saving lives. And we also know that it was challenging for people, even Democrats, who one in states where they are traditionally red or perhaps even purple. They were terrified of the NRA. So I would say that it's time for the American people to stand up to the NRA and say, you will not fund these elections to the point that we are literally losing lives regularly, whether it's because someone has mental illness or not. The bottom line is you shouldn't have access to these kinds of weapons. Second Amendment rights. I give you the right to bear arms. It does not give you the right to shoot and kill with vengeance and evil in your heart. That is completely different. So I don't care what else is on the table. We need to listen to these young people who are crying out, saying, I saw this, I witnessed this, this will scar me for the rest of my life. It is time for you to do something. Set your ego aside, set your politics aside, and do what's right by me as a human being.
Well, so since you mentioned those young people, Angela, we have a little bit of tape here from 16-year-old shooting survivor Alfonso Calderon speaking after rallying this morning at the Florida State House about disappointment that Alfonso feels after the Florida state government failed to debate a proposed regulation of semi-automatic weapons.
I don't know if I'm going to have faith in my state and local government anymore, because what I saw today was discouraging. But I want everybody here today to know we will not be discouraged. We will not falter. We will not stop this movement, because this is more than just us. This is everybody in America. This is for every single kid who fears for their life.
So, Paris, I'm curious. Do you think that this is the genesis of a movement that could lead to broader regulations beyond tightening the federal background check system or those bump stocks?
I don't think this is a movement. I think that what it is, as you see, because of social media, because of people being more aware of activist millennials, that they have a bigger megaphone. And I think that you have a willingness, I think, from this president to find common solutions to have a win for the American people and a win for safety and a win for protecting lives. And so I think there's going to be some positive outcomes. But if you look at this as in terms of just blanket gun control and just massive gun control overhauls, I don't think that that's practical. And I don't think that that's what's going to happen. I think they're going to look for specific things to point to say, what can we do to prevent these types of instances from happening so that this destruction cannot occur? Because it's not just banning guns, or it could be looking at these schools being just sitting there as open targets because of these gun-free zones. I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done outside of just quote-unquote banning guns or gun control. So I think there's going to be a more comprehensive approach in finding real positive solutions that make a direct impact. And the president is showing that through the listening session today and the bump stocks issue and the Cornyn bill.
Yeah, go ahead.
Harris, I got to say I'm confused because a moment ago you said there need to be specific targeted measures taken, and then you just said comprehensive. So to me, my confusion just lies in the fact that those two things don't peacefully coexist, right? Like, we do need a comprehensive solution. We are the only society in the world that has this type of problem with gun issues, with gun safety, with keeping our kids safe, with keeping people in their places of worship safe. And so at some point we have to say, whatever we're doing is not working. So why don't we lay aside everything that stands in the way of us being able to protect American lives, people on American soil, because right now what we're doing is not working. That is a comprehensive solution. It is not a piecemeal approach. That has not worked.
I think when I talked about comprehensive solution, I was talking about not just looking at banning guns. You've got to look at the fact that our schools
are sitting targets. Who suggested that? I've heard of an assault rifle ban, but I've not heard of people talking about banning guns. That's fear-mongering, Paris, in a very vulnerable time for the American people. Wouldn't you agree with that? Who's talking about banning guns, period?
I think this is a very fearful time for a lot of Americans, mm-hmm. especially those that are living in places like Chicago, where you have regular gun violence. And from Martin Luther King Day until the issue of that happened at Parkland, there were 17 deaths because of guns and over 80 people were injured because of gun violence. And so we can look at Chicago and say, what has worked in terms of their gun control laws? And so it's much more, and my point is, it's much more than just talking about gun control. It's the sitting targets that are our schools. It's
so,
the
so
fact
Paris,
that,
let me just jump in. Let me just jump in here. Let me just jump in here. Actually, I mean, to your point, maybe then the federal government ought to allow public health officials to study gun violence as a public health issue and fund that, which they're not. But I just want to, you know, you're talking about piecemeal here. I just want to just point out something that about the president's statement about bump stocks, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms have said that they can't do any regulation on bump stocks unless there's legislation from mm-hmm. Congress. So, but I guess I'm saying, like, the idea that this is a big shift in terms of President Trump's view, he might be saying stuff, but it may not lead to any significant action.
Well, it could lead to significant action because the president, when the president takes the bully pulpit, when the president goes to Twitter and makes it known to the party, makes it known to the people, and makes it known to the Congress what is important to him, that's what he can possibly do. And I hope that they would be responsive to that and listen to what the president is directing the government to do.
But that's not what he directed. He directed Jeff Sessions to come up with bump stock regulations. And the issue is he did that yesterday. And then today he's calling him Jeff Sessions just one. And he is criticizing him and therefore undermining him. If it takes legislation, then what he should be doing is urging the Senate to consider Senator Feinstein's bill, which is what she suggested. He's not talking about pushing legislation. He's talking about regulations through the Department of Justice.
Okay.
About Senator Cornyn's bill. So that he is talking about something on when it comes to legislation.
In the minute that we have left, speaking of inaction in Congress, I just want to point out one more thing, which is that March 5th is the deadline for DACA, and there's still no solution yet. Just briefly, each of you, Paris, quickly, what do you think? Will they come up with a solution to protect the Dreamers?
Democrats are going to have to work with the Republicans who are in control to get something on the table. The president has laid out what his vision is for this, and he's laid out a very comprehensive strategy to get this thing done. It's up to the Congress. He put it on the Congress's plate because it's their responsibility to do it. They need to act.
Angela?
I agree. The Congress needs to act. Republicans have control of both chambers. I look forward them to acting with compassion, with open arms instead of building walls.
Angela Rye, a Democratic strategist who, by the way, I was watching on TV the other day hosting the pregame show for the All-Star game for the NBA.
I know. Thanks for a shout-out, Jeremy.
Absolutely. And maybe we'll see Paris on there next time. I haven't seen him on that show yet, but maybe. Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Thanks to both of you. Let's get an update from the Winter Olympics. Joining us is NPR's Russell Lewis, who's in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Russell, start with the U.S. skier Lindsey Vonn, who won a bronze medal in the downhill last night.
Yeah, you know, I mean, she was happy with getting the medal. She'd been favored to win a gold in the downhill. It really is her specialty. She won gold in Vancouver in 2010, got injured, didn't compete in the 2014 Olympics in Sochi. And so this was really sort of, she was coming out and this essentially is going to be her final Olympics. And, you know, she came out swinging initially and in the first couple of runs, she found herself in the silver medal position, but at the very end, ended up getting a bronze.
And she was actually in tears after that happened. I saw an interview with her on television.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's something that she's been working towards for a while. I mean, not being able to compete during the Sochi Olympics was very difficult for her. And so she came into these Olympics really on a mission to win and to win a lot. And, you know, here she is, you know, on the podium and very happy with the bronze medal and, you know, has one more race to go. And that's the women's alpine combined.
The U.S. men's hockey team is now out. This was a team of college and minor league players, no one from the NHL. Is that what this is about? Did that put the U.S. at a disadvantage?
Oh, yeah, most certainly. I mean, you know, the U.S. has always dominated in men's hockey, you know, in large part when the NHL allowed its players to play, but they didn't this time around. And it was sort of a tough go. And boy, the game against the Czech Republic was tough. I mean, it was back and forth and back and forth, and then it ended up going into overtime. They were tied at two, and even that didn't decide it. And they went to a shootout. And so, unfortunately, the U.S. actually did not score a single goal during each of its five shots. The Czech Republic only got one goal, but that was all that they needed, and they ended up advancing, and the U.S. is done, at least on the men's hockey side of things.
On the women's side, the American women play for the gold tonight against Canada.
Absolutely, and it's going to be a great game. You know, these two teams are always in the mix. You know, since women's hockey was introduced into the Olympics back in 1998, either the U.S. or Canada has won gold medal. Canada has won the last four gold medals. The U.S., you know, has won one gold, has won a silver and some bronze as well. And so, but, you know, they're set to win another medal again. And this actually is going to be one of the great matchups of these Olympics, seeing these two great hockey-loving countries, you know, going at it again, and we're just going to have to see who ultimately wins out.
When you look at who is doing really well in the medal count, it's like a tour of the coldest countries on earth. You've got, you know, Norway and Canada and Germany doing well. The U.S., it seems like, is not doing as well as people expected so far.
That's fair. You know, they had not done as well really up until today. You know, today there've actually been a number of key wins. I think one of the biggest medals that the U.S. got today was one that they probably weren't expecting to get, and that was a medal in U.S. women's cross-country skiing. The United States has never won a medal on the women's side ever, but they won tonight, and they won not only a medal, but they won a gold, and that was Keegan Randall and Jesse Diggins beat Sweden and the bronze medalists Norway in the women's team sprint freestyle final. And so that's one key thing. But it has been sort of a difficult go on some levels for the U.S. They have not won as many medals as they had hoped that they would win. But as we've seen, the Olympics are not done yet, and there are still many chances for the U.S. to bounce back.
One of the most watched events at every Winter Olympics, it seems, or at least most talked about, is curling. And the South Korean curling team demolished Russia in competition. They'll be competing in the semifinals on Friday. They're known as the Garlic Girls.
Yeah, and they've really become this great hit sensation here in South Korea. They're called the Garlic Girls because everyone on the team is from this one small town about 2.5 hours south of Seoul. And this area where they're from is known for producing garlic. So they've called themselves the Garlic Girls. And it has really become this major hit. We had a reporter who was there for us yesterday and was talking to folks who live in the town that all these girls went to the same school. And curling is just not something that is just known in South Korea. It's only been around, played here for the last 10 or so years. And it is something where it has become so exciting. And because of the success of their team, they're now into the semifinals and they're actually 7-1 and they have beat some powerhouses in curling already to get to this level. And here they are, the whole country is just so thoroughly excited and energized by it, a sport that until very recently was just something they didn't know much about.
Russell, overall, I have to say the games look beautiful. And we've just had a few Olympic games in Sochi and in Rio where there were all kinds of problems leading up to them. And would they be able to actually make it happen? It seems like the South Koreans really did a good job. At least that's what it looks like from here. What about where you are?
Oh, yeah. I mean, things seem to be running, you know, very, very smoothly here. You know, the venues all seem to, you know, we're all completed roughly on time. The transportation of moving people around, you know, has just not been an issue. They built a new high-speed rail line from Seoul to here to help shuttle people back and forth, and it's just not really been much of an issue. You know, I mean, there's always some difficulty any time that the Olympics comes to town. You know, on the mountains where they've been doing some of the skiing, they actually had to sort of get rid of some centuries-old trees that were just historically significant to South Korea, but they chose to do it because of the Olympics. You know, the first week of the games was dominated by super cold weather and high winds that were postponing many events. But, you know, over the last week, it's been quite nice, although we are hearing that the winds are supposed to return in a couple of days. And that's why they've been moving up some of these other skiing events by a day or two, hoping to get them in before the games officially end on Sunday.
And the next Olympic Games, by the way, the 2020 Summer Olympics will be in Tokyo. Beijing is hosting the Winter Olympics in 2022. It seems like a move toward a certain part of the world.
Yeah, you know, I mean, just having three games in a row be held here in Asia is something that the IOC had wanted to do, but it's not something that's going to be permanent. Of course, the 2024 Olympics are going to be held in Paris, and the 2028 Olympics are going to be held in Los Angeles. So, you know, the Olympics are always about moving around the world as best they can. And so that's just something that they do is, you know, they move around quite a bit and try to showcase as much of the world as they can.
That's NPR's Russell Lewis at the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Russell, thank you. Enjoy the rest of the games.
Hey, thanks so much.
The Reverend Billy Graham died today at the age of 99. He was known as America's pastor and pastor to presidents. In a remarkable career that spanned more than 60 years, he preached to millions in more than 400 crusades, as he called them. And through television and radio, he reached billions worldwide. Graham told the journalist David Frost that he wanted the first line of his obituary to say that he was faithful and that he had integrity. Joining us now with more is Grant Wacker, professor emeritus of Christian history at Duke Divinity School and author of the book America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation. Professor Wacker, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. So, good to be here.
I mean, how would you, this may be an impossible task, but briefly, I mean, how would you describe Billy Graham's impact on American Christianity?
Graham was instrumental in bringing the modern evangelical movement together as a coherent religious movement. There had been disparate streams flowing before his rise, of course, but he brought them together and into a kind of self-conscious religious movement that was, in his mind, that would run down the middle of the religious or Protestant landscape. Fundamentalists on the right and mainline Protestants on the left, but he wanted a movement that would speak for the great center stream.
Right. I mean, and so he brought those many denominations together. He also, though, theologically, though, had his critics, right? Those folks who said that his reading of the Bible was perhaps too literal and too simplistic and that Graham was preaching redemption simply through the act of deciding.
Yeah, he had critics from many angles.
Yeah.
And his fundamentalist critics were at least as harsh as any critics on coming from the mainstream. Yeah, but the people on the mainstream side felt that he focused too much on individual change, individual conversion. And Graham was quite clear about it. He felt that if we're going to have a better world, we need better people.
Right.
And better people begins where the problem lies. It's in the greed and selfishness of the individual heart.
Right. You know, it's interesting because he preached to integrated audiences. He said he didn't want to bring Jim Crow into his ministry. So he had an effect there on America's social scene, but also these relationships, remarkable relationships with American presidents. How did that happen?
Well, it happened partly because he wanted them to happen. He was not shy about seeking audiences. It did not just drop from the sky like a sacred meteor. He made an effort to meet them, starting with Harry Truman, and that did not go well.
Mm-hmm.
But every other president that he met with and became friends with, it was a positive relationship, as well as with their wives, his wife and their wives. And so he worked at it, but he also was a charismatic personality. He was a titanic personality, and I think presidents recognize that.
Professor Wacker, we have just 30 seconds here, but I do want to ask you one more question. Billy Graham was assiduously apolitical in his later career, but American evangelism seems to have gone in a different direction. Is there room in the faith today for someone like Billy Graham?
I hope so. He stressed increasingly strongly in his later years that the faith should be nonpartisan. The message should rise above partisan politics.
Well, Grant Wacker is Professor Emeritus of Christian History at Duke University and author of America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. A new year has begun, and if you are setting new goals for your business, you need the right people on your team. And ZipRecruiter has transformed how you find them. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 job boards with just one click, then actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter. The smartest way to hire. Right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Some news from the world of retail now, starting with a farewell to Priceline.
Finally planning a trip to Cancun? I'm on it.
Remember those? Well, starting today, the discount travel company, the Priceline Group, will go by Booking Holdings. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
So why this name change? Priceline's been around since the 90s. It's a strong brand.
Yeah, it is. And that campy campaign was so fun. You know, so many people really recognize that. But Priceline's really only big in the U.S. Globally, it's Booking.com. That's the site that most people use. It accounts for something like 80% of the company's revenue. It's much bigger than some of their properties like Priceline, Kayak, etc. So they thought that the name should represent that. They've actually been talking about it for some time. And they say they also think that Booking Holdings kind of better reflects the idea that all of their properties involve some kind of online booking, which I guess makes sense, but it's going to take some getting used to here in the U.S.
Well, and it sounds like they want more of a focus on hotel and vacation rentals rather than maybe flights.
Yeah, I don't know if they're emphasizing one or the other. I think they're just really aware of the keen competition in that area, not only, of course, from Airbnb, which is what you think of immediately, but increasingly the hotels themselves, which are trying to encourage consumers to book directly. We just went through this for a family trip. We were booking in May, and my husband called the hotel directly to ask about deals, and they absolutely worked with him and matched anything we could find online. So, you know, consumers are price conscious. Bookings doesn't want them leaving the site for hotel room, because then they may end up booking everything, the rent rental car, the flights somewhere else as well. So they're trying to keep you in that ecosystem.
Some other retail news today. We got word that Gap's president and CEO Jeff Kirwan is leaving. He was not able to turn around that brand. What happened?
Yeah, you know, Gap is just in the fashion wilderness, and it's just a shame. It was such a sort of iconic must-go-to spot for so many people for so long, but the basics are just too boring and bland now for consumers that are really used to this fast fashion, you know, the Zaras, Uniqlos, all that other stuff out there. You know, they have made some progress. They've closed some stores. They've stabilized those same store sales, but they just need to breathe some life into this and to give people a reason to come back through the door, and I guess they need try to find a new person to lead that charge. It's been a tough one.
One more thing, Maggie. Taco Bell is now the fourth largest restaurant chain in the country. It has surpassed Burger King. Wow. So Doritos, Locos Tacos now more popular than the Whopper.
Yes, they are. I mean, listen, talk about fun campaigns, right? Live Mas. Who doesn't want to live Mas? I mean, they have done an amazing job. I have to tell you, Jeremy, I've never had the pleasure of eating at Taco Bell ever.
Really?
Yes, but I have interviewed the Yum CEO a lot of times, actually, both of them. And
they never brought any tacos with them to
give
to
you? Oh, they did. They did, but too early in the morning for when I catch them. But they have emphasized again and again the strength of their marketing. They're very big on social media. They're very funny. They're very quick. They really appeal to millennials. And they change things up on the menu as well. So they've kind of got it all going in the right direction for that young demographic, and it's really, really paid off for them. So it's no surprise that they're continuing to grow that footprint and to overtake something like Burger King.
And perhaps no surprise that Chipotle has hired their CEO of Taco Bell to come over to Chipotle.
Yeah, I'm sure they're hoping they bring some of that marketing magic, but they have a much more pressing job, and that's to get a handle on food safety and get that supply chain cleaned up there. That's the first job.
Maggie Lake, co-CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, go get a taco.
I think I will, Jeremy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School are in Tallahassee, Florida today. They're there to rally and to urge leaders, including Governor Rick Scott, to examine ways to increase gun regulations and fund mental health support in the state. The students took the 7-hour bus ride to the Capitol just a week after a shooting at their school left 17 people dead. Yesterday, the Florida legislature voted down a motion to consider a ban on semi-automatic weapons, such as the AR-15-style rifle used in last week's shooting. Stoneman Douglas students watched on from the gallery. They're also set to meet with Governor Scott later today. NPR's Brackton Booker is in Tallahassee, and he joined us a bit earlier from the scene of the rally. And I started by asking him what he was seeing and what the students there hope to achieve.
Well, okay, so there's a big group of students and other activists marching towards the Capitol right now, to the old Capitol building. They're holding signs showing, you know, their blood is on your hands. Protect kids, not guns. And they're chanting right now, I believe that we will win. They really want to see some real common sense gun changes here. That obviously is going to be an uphill battle in a Republican-controlled state house.
I see. So on that point, Brackton, I mean, have you had a chance to talk to students about what their reaction was to the decision yesterday in Florida to vote down a motion to consider a ban on semi-automatic weapons?
Yeah, you know, a lot of students were disappointed, obviously. They thought they really had some momentum after the shooting last week at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where they drove up on buses yesterday. People were upset because they thought, hey, you know, this is the chance to actually do something. You see our faces, you see the anguish on our faces, you know our story. Some of the members of the state legislature came down to Florida and saw blood stains on the school campus. So they thought, of course, this is our chance to get this done. But they got a real lesson in how difficult it is to change laws. And they're meeting with members of the state legislature throughout the day and hoping that if they can stay in their faces and come into their offices and kind of sit in on some of their committee meetings, that they will change minds. But I got to tell you, there are only a couple more days left in the legislative session here. It ends on March 9th, so there's really not a whole lot of time to make anything happen this legislative session.
Interesting. Now, at the rally today, Sounds like there's a lot going on. Is it mostly students from Stoneman Douglas High School or from other parts of Florida?
Oh, no. There are people from all over. I mean, the students are the face of this, but, I mean, there are lots of adults here. There looks to be students from nearby colleges. Florida State is here. Florida AMU is here. And there are other groups here that are just saying this is time to get behind these students, these high school students, to enact change. So right now, there's got to be, a couple thousand people in front of the steps of the Capitol with the rally. So there are only about 100 students that took the buses up from Stoneman Douglas. So this is showing that the movement is strong and it has momentum here.
Well, that's NPR's Brakton Booker joining us from just outside the state capitol in Tallahassee, Florida. Brakton, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Oxfam, one of the UK's largest charities, is reeling from a scandal. Some 7,000 people have stopped making regular donations since allegations emerged that Oxfam staff used prostitutes in Haiti. Oxfam chief Mark Goldring spoke to the British Parliament earlier this week.
I am sorry, we are sorry, for the damage that Oxfam has done, both to the people of Haiti, but also to wider efforts for aid and development by possibly undermining public support.
The BBC's diplomatic correspondent James Landale joins us from London. And James, tell us first, what are the specific allegations against Oxfam staff in Haiti?
Well, what happened is there was an earthquake in Haiti in 2010, and the place was flooded with aid workers, many of them obviously from organizations like Oxfam. And it turns out that seven of the men who were working for Oxfam there were not just looking after people, but they were also exploiting women. Some of them were using prostitutes on Oxfam property. But it was exploitative. It was about young women who were in dire need. And that need was being exploited by men who had power because they were the people who had the food, the water, and the shelter that people needed.
How long did Oxfam know about this?
Well, Oxfam heard about it at the time and it investigated. And the investigation was complete. And as a result, this, as I said, this disciplinary action was taken. However, none of this evidence was given to the Haitian authorities. A view was taken by Oxfam that the circumstances were so chaotic that the police would not have time to deal with this. But that was a decision that Oxfam made and now thoroughly regrets. At the same time, Oxfam did not tell the British regulator, the Charity Commission, as it should have done, nor did it tell any of its donors. What it did publicise was that they had a disciplinary problem and there had been some bullying and intimidation and some people had left Oxfam as a result. There was the key fact that they were not transparent about was the fact that there was sexual exploitation going on.
Mm. So are British charity regulators, as you just mentioned, are they now looking into or asking Oxfam to be more forthcoming about what it may or may not know about other areas where they're doing work? I mean, because they're in conflict zones all around the world. Are there concerns?
The Charity Commission is investigating. So is Committee of British Parliamentarians. So is the British government. So is Oxfam itself. They set up their own, or are in the process of setting up their own internal commission. Oxfam is aware, I think, of quite how bad this is for their reputation. So their senior executives have been appearing before British parliamentary committees, repeatedly apologising for what went on, fully admitting that Oxfam did not handle this particularly well. And they are trying to see what can be done in the future to reform things so that this thing cannot happen again. And there are lots of ideas out there that are being considered about other ways of having things like sort of special passports for humanitarian workers, so that when you have a major crisis or natural disaster where all the aid agencies are hiring anybody that they can lay their hands on, there's a sort of quality control, and the people who are hired have to have a piece of paper or a passport that says, I have a clean set of references. Because one of the things that has emerged from this scandal is that a lot of people knew what was going on and knew about some of the behaviour of these people, and then they were either moved from one bit of Oxfam to another or from one agency to another.
So that makes it sound like even though action was taken, that they were covering it up as they knew it.
Well, Oxfam technically denies the phrase cover-up. What they admit to is being not being explicit, lacking transparency. Their argument is that at the time, the Oxfam executives who made this decision were trying to balance the need to be open about what had happened, but also with the potential consequences that it might have on the aid effort. The more publicity was given to this and the full details are all known. That is an analysis that Oxfam says was given at the time, but they now disagree with that and regret it.
How much is this terrible story? What impact is it having on Oxfam as an organization and its ability to do its work worldwide now?
Oxfam is reeling. I think the problem is whether or not they can turn this round. As you say, they've lost donations, 7,000 people since this story was first broken by the London Times newspaper, have stopped their direct debits, their regular contributions. However, well over 300,000 Britons have direct debits with Oxfam, so they're still getting a lot of cash. The problem is this. The British government has said that they will suspend their own public funding of Oxfam unless Oxfam gets its house in order. And so I think that's the challenge, the hard task that Oxfam has got ahead. But clearly, it's had a huge impact on Oxfam, but it's also had a massive impact on the aid sector as a whole. Because this is clearly not a problem that is limited to Oxfam.
Right. Well, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, James Landale, speaking to us from London. James, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
There have been thousands of spills from oil and gas pipelines in this country over the past decade, and when a major pipeline like the Keystone XL breaks, it gets national attention. But in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, thousands of miles of smaller pipelines are being built, and they have far less oversight. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports there are concerns about the impact they'll have on smaller streams and the wildlife that live near them.
High school students file into Nicole Costello's small reptiles class at the Penta Career Center in Toledo, Ohio.
All right, welcome, welcome to this.
They're learning firsthand how to foster an aquatic species that experts say is in decline, the eastern hellbender salamander. In a biosecured room on campus, 18-year-old Teresa Paff and other students clean the glass tanks, weigh and cut up worms to feed the young hellbenders they're raising. Paff picks one up.
This is really hard to hold. They always like to move, and they're so slimy and slippery.
Greg Lips is an expert on hellbenders at Ohio State University and works with the high school program.
They're kind of a flattened, wrinkly-sided, beady-eyed salamander. Everything about them is made to live underneath a big rock in tight spots and darkness.
The adults can get big, over 2 feet long, and can live 35 years or more. They're found in streams along the Appalachian Mountains in Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio. The species has survived for at least a million years, which is why Lips was so concerned by the sharp decline in their populations in Ohio. They just don't find many young hellbenders.
It's kind of like if the whole world became a nursing home overnight. You know that the end is near if you don't have any youngsters in these populations.
Researchers say the problem has to do with increased sediment in Ohio's streams. Young hellbenders are thought to live in little spaces and gravel beds that are easily filled with sediment. Lips has watched as waterways, especially in the steep Appalachian hills, have gotten muddier in the past few years. The reason seems obvious to him: pipelines.
Not rocket science when you see the muddy water to drive upstream until you see clear water and then figure out, well, what's happening? Where's the in-between? And when I've done that, it's been pipeline construction.
Back taxiing runway 24, Marshall County.
To get a better picture of the gas pipeline boom here, Ted Alk of Frack Tracker, a nonprofit that tracks the fracking industry, has organized a tour by plane of West Virginia and Ohio. As we get into the air, he points out how many hillsides are cleared of trees to make way for pipelines.
Look at how big and ragged this puppy is.
Ohio and Pennsylvania are among the states with the most lines in the country, each with more than 20,000 miles connecting every well pad and compressor station. Pipeline companies are supposed to replant the pipeline corridors, but Alk says many don't.
That's all pipeline, see? And they have not hydroseeded that. You see what I'm talking about? And they've got that apron, that tarping material that's just supposed to prevent the loading of sediment down, but they didn't hydroseed any of that.
Ohio State researcher Greg Lipp says when companies strip these hillsides of forest for pipelines, it can destroy his team's efforts to restore stream banks and protect the habitat for eastern hellbenders and other aquatic species.
What you create is effectively what can be a river of mud every time it rains. Now, it's really a problem, and the amount of silt and sediment that can come from a pipeline cut and from an eroding stream bank is immense.
Many of the new pipelines also cross the streams themselves, like here in Captina Creek, a high-quality stream and home to hellbenders. The Ohio Environmental Protection Agency has issued at least 13 pipeline permits, including 66 stream crossings in the Captina Creek watershed since 2014. Harry Kalapolitis manages the Ohio EPA's permitting process. His agency, as required by the Clean Water Act, certifies that pipeline crossings are not going to jeopardize the stream quality.
We evaluate what benefits to society it may have and weigh that against the potential impacts to water quality. And we do authorize the potential lowering of water quality with potential mitigation to make up for that loss.
Kalapolitis says there's no regulation looking at the cumulative impacts of all the new lines. But he says they have not seen impacts on any streams from multiple pipeline crossings, including in Captina Creek.
We evaluate a lot of streams in Ohio. And, you know, to my knowledge, we haven't had any of those reports come back to us and say that the stream is jeopardized by multiple crossings associated with pipeline projects.
Still, Kalapolitis says the Ohio EPA will propose new sediment regulations for pipelines in the coming months. And now researchers at West Virginia University are starting to look at ways to plan pipelines to reduce their impact on waterways. Like the students at the Penta Career Center in Toledo, they want the rivers clear enough so species like the eastern hellbenders continue to survive in this region. The high schoolers will join experts this summer to release the young salamanders they're raising back into the streams of eastern Ohio. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.